I'm Ivy.
I'm Rachel, and we are Swords and Sapphics, a podcast all about representation, queer media, women with a capital W, and a little bit of nonsense.
So start sharpening your swords, sip your tea, and join us as we obsess over the wonderful beings that are women.
Hello.
Hello.
Today we have a really exciting episode.
We do.
We are interviewing
Oliver Brackenbury, editor of the New Edge Sword and Sorcery magazine.
And we're gonna jump straight into the interview and talk a little bit after.
Enjoy. Today we're here with Oliver Brackenbury, who is the editor of the New Edge Sword and Sorcery magazine. So if you want to introduce yourself to our audience.
Well, certainly. So my name is Oliver Brackenbury. I'm an author and screenwriter and in recent years, publisher. Now I publish New Edge Sword and Sorcery magazine, which was launched with a blood, sweat and tears. Nobody's getting paid free issue zero in 2022. And then last year, we crowdfunded successfully our first two issues, one and two, proper issues, I guess you'd say, traditionally printed, which is very exciting, including a story by Michael Moorcock, the latest Elric. And now, as of this recording, this very moment, we are less than a week from going into crowdfunding our next two issues, three and four, on the BackerKit platform, which we switched to for reasons. So I'll be going out February 15th on BackerKit. Just go there and search for New Edge Sword and Sorcery. Plus, I'll give you guys a link if you want to throw that in the show notes. But yeah, that's the gist of me, real quick, like.
Amazing. Thank you
Wonderful.
for joining
Thank you.
us.
Yeah, thank
And
you.
we'll be sure to post all the links in our episode description and whatnot as well. And we'll talk about the Kickstarter a little bit later in the episode. But how did you be the editor of the New Edge Sword and Sorcery magazine?
I said I'm the editor, and that's how it happened. But maybe a little more specifically. Long story short. So there is another magazine called Whetstone, magazine of amateur, sorry, amateur magazine of sword and sorcery, which is a great place for people who want to get their first publication. They're very focused on getting people started. Very short stories, 1500 to 2500 words. Anyway, they have a lovely Discord where I was hanging out, chatting with other people about Conan and Elric and all these things. And one year, 2022, early in that year, a circular conversation that kind of happens in the scene over and over again, it came up once more. It was just like, how do we get more people reading it? And how do we get more younger people reading it? Because, for those who aren't familiar, sword and sorcery is a term that has become a little diluted in the last 20 odd years. I think to a lot of people, it's another synonym for fantasy at large, when actually it's like a distinct fantasy. Sorry, I'm trying not to do that, but it is actually a distinct fantasy subgenre with a history going back almost 100 years to the pulp magazines of the 30s, birthed by Robert E. Howard with his character Conan, who's still probably the most recognizable one. Anyway, so people were like, how do we, get more people into this? Because right now it looks like it's mostly, mostly guys sort of 35 and older, really a bit older than that still. And it's just looking, not everybody was saying this, but me and a couple of people were saying this. It's looking very like white cis het male. How do we make this more welcoming to everybody? How do we get everybody in there? And I'm like, usually that conversation would kind of go in a circle and somebody would be like, make a hit movie. And it's like, yeah, okay, I'll get on that. But for whatever reason, this particular time, it was a bit more productive and there was a ferocious energy and lots of people wanting to do something new. Luckily, there was another fellow there, Howard Andrew Jones, who edits a magazine called Tales from the Magician's Skull, which I strongly recommend. Excellent publication. And he was saying, well, in the 2000s, him and some friends tried to get a term going, which to try and like knock the rust off, as it were, because at that point, sword and sorcery, if you did know it as a distinct thing, you would think of mostly really bad movies from the 80s, and it kind of came off a bit crap, which is a shame because it's not. So he's like, well, if we called it like New Edge Sword and Sorcery, you burnish that blade, you take off, the grub of the kind of, crappy Clonans they'd be called from the 80s and stuff, or some of the retrograde attitudes of the older authors. I mean, you go back more than 20 years in any genre, you're going to find that. And just make it fresh and new, and kind of bring forward the stuff that's really good and preserve that. I think the 2000s was a little too soon. The term didn't quite take off. But when he mentioned it in 2022, I was like, yeah, I really like that. That's really cool. And so we all got chatting about it, and eventually somebody was like, well, what are you going to do exactly? And someone said, why don't you do an anthology? And I said, no, but I have been thinking about doing a magazine for 2 years and I just haven't had a focus yet. This feels like a good focus. So I reached out to a couple other people on the server. I was like, do you want to help me? Because you can't do this on your own. It's a big endeavor. And I was very lucky. You know, a few different people, Nathaniel Webb, who's our layout design guy, was the first to sign up. Kevin Beckett, our social media coordinator, and Jordan Douglas Smith, who was our copy editor for the first three issues, all, you know, joined the team, as it were, and off to the races we went. You know, we grabbed some authors and artists. We said, hey, guys, you know, we have no money, but we have lots of time and energy and skills at hand. How about we do like a sweat equity issue zero and put it out on Amazon POD just to be like, do we want to do a magazine? Well, let's find out, you know, and to show people like what we can do. That went very well. I certainly found out that I love doing a magazine. I love being an editor. I love working with lots of artists, and because we do art with all our articles and stories as well as the writing. And I love working with creatives and treating them the way I always want to be treated. You know, it's a nice opportunity to do that. So, you know, we put that issue out. People seem to really like it. We put it out at cost, so it was a good promotional tool, right? Like, it's only $4 on Amazon if you want to try it in softcover, free, you know, in EPUB and all that. And we also just for fun did hardcover, because who's doing hardcover magazines? Nobody right now that I'm aware of. But when I was visiting my folks, I tripped over a magazine from the 60s called Horizon. It's kind of a National Geographic-ish thing. And I was like, holy crap, you can have like a nice, beautiful hardcover with three columns. Big, beautiful. I was like, let's try and do this. Let's make something really gorgeous for people who like the physical object as well as the actual content, right? And yeah, it came out, people liked it. And, you know, it was not a little more than 6 months from when I just said magazine, question mark, that we were crowdfunding issues 1 and 2. And, you know, we got very lucky and had a lot of great contributors, including no less than, as I mentioned earlier, the legendary Michael Moorcock, who gifted us with what is still currently the latest Elric story, which was a real shot in the arm. So yeah, and then, you know, it's been, like I say, it's been about a year since then, and now we're off to the races with the next two issues. Which we have a bunch of fun stuff to talk about later, but this is already perhaps too long an answer to your question. So yeah, how do you become an editor of a magazine? You basically find inspiration and decide to do it, and then take all the skills you have from whatever you've done before. You know, I've done a lot of independent film and television kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And I found that the skills I had from producing like web series and short films and that sort of thing, promotional skills I learned from, you know, I've gone through, Canada has a National Screen Institute, and I've gone through their TV pitching program. So I've learned a lot about like getting people hyped about your creative thing. You know, I just found that a lot of the skills I picked up along the way doing other creative endeavors all fed into this quite nicely. So I was fortunate there. Yeah.
Wonderful. Amazing. Thank you. You mentioned you have a lot of contributors. Are there any creators you'd love to work with in the future?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, some of them I've been chasing from the start and I still haven't gotten there yet. I would love to work. I don't even know. I'm not sure actually she even does short stories still anymore, but I would love to work with Silvia Moreno Garcia. She did a great Sword and Sorcery novella called Return of the Sorceress, which I feel like is a bit slept on because they didn't release it in softcover. It was just like a really expensive hardcover and then EPUB. But it's hunted down, you know, and she's apparently returning to that universe with a new trilogy that just got announced recently. So I'd love to work with her. You know, I'd love to work with N.K. Jemison. I'd love to work with C.L. Clarke. I'd love to work with Naylor Hopkinson, who I know is a big fan of Charles Saunders. For those of you who don't know, he was the first person of color to write Sword and Sorcery, and he birthed a kind of subsection, Sword and Soul, which is just, you know, Sword and Sorcery, but rooted in fantastic African cultural stuff as opposed to the usual Western European. Yeah, I mean, that's just off the top of my head. There's a whole bunch of other people, but yeah, that's I mean, Neil Gaiman, if you're out there, you know, gimme, I mean, that'd be fun. Why not? You know, Joe Abercrombie, if he wants to throw me an Abercrumb, that would be nice. but yeah, lots and lots and lots of people, as well as just, you know, more first timers, you know, because I mean, mm-hmm. It's fun to talk about the big names and they're great for your project because they put bums in seats. But as proud as I am of having published, as I say, the latest Elric by Michael Moorcock, I'm also really proud of having published June Orchid Parker, who is a brand new author. And I published her very first story last year. And that mm-hmm. felt great because, you know, Yeah, it's nice to have the full gamut, you know, in terms of experience in the magazine. Yeah.
Wonderful.
So you talk about kind of getting new and older influences that you'd like to include. What was the selection process like for the magazine? How do you decide which pieces to feature, and what do you hope to see more of in future submissions?
Well, actually, right now, we're not taking submissions. Okay. We will eventually open to submissions. I know that is something I should do, but I'm scared. It's a lot of work doing a submission file. And I've been trying to be very careful not to overwhelm myself with this project because it's so big and can just expand almost indefinitely, right? So it's like with issue zero, I thought, okay, well, let's just see if I can make a magazine. Okay, fine. And then once I did that, I was like, okay, let's see if we can do like traditional printing and the crowdfunding and put all that together. So that was the next two issues, and so on. So I keep trying to add new challenges. You know, one of the ones for these, the latest issues 3 and 4, is working with a legacy property. You know, we're bringing back Jorella Jarry for her first story in 85 years. For those who don't know, Jorella Jarry is a really compelling character for a bunch of reasons, but also factually, she was the very first sort of sword and sorcery heroine written by the very first woman sword and sorcery author, Catherine L. Moore. And so like working with an estate to bring back a legacy character is like a new challenge. So eventually we're going to get to submissions. I'm probably issue 7, I'm thinking, because by that point we'll have really established our voice and made it clear what we're looking for, which I think will be helpful for that. But yeah, so back to your question. Sorry, I'm kind of talking around it. So, you know, in terms of direct commissions and me seeking people out, like I said, I've been just trying to find like a good mix of some of the established heavyweights like Moorcock, as well as bringing in new people and people who you don't see as much of in the scene. You know, like I say, it's I really want to make the scene sort of, what's this phrase, like widen the circle a little bit, you know, make it a bit more welcoming to people outside of my own personal demographic, who sometimes people get their backs up and go, oh, well, what about, you know, the white guys, you don't want them in there? I'm like, well, I want me in there, so, you know, that's fine. Including means adding, it doesn't mean subtracting. So I do try to mind myself and sort of see, like, you know, am I reading broadly, am I looking at authors from a broad variety of backgrounds? And of course, some of them will hear this and go, well, are the stories any good? Are you going to get someone just because they're whatever? No, you can have two priorities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You can have two parallel priorities, mm-hmm. amazingly. You can want the stories to be good and want to be careful that, you know, you have some broad degree of representation as best you can in the magazine. So that's kind of like a mix of what I'm looking for. Is I'm looking for people who are younger or older in various groups and intersections of groups. I'm looking for... yeah, people at various points in their careers as well. You know, I really, like I said, I really love giving people a boost at the beginning. And also mid-career authors often have trouble because they haven't got that sexy, exciting newness, nor are they yet legends, right? So trying, you know, even just like experience is something I'm trying to get a broad spectrum of. In terms of the content, yeah, like I say, I mean, our stories, it's always sword and sorcery, but I feel it's a very flexible genre. That's one thing I really love about it. It's there's a lot of ways to define it, and I kind of joke sometimes that arguing over the definition of it is itself sword and sorcery, because the conversations get so intense about it. But my personal favorite definition is from a book I really give a shout out to called Flame and Crimson, A History of Sword and Sorcery by Brian Murphy. It's a wonderful history of the genre. I strongly recommend it. My copy's got highlighter all over it. And his definition, what I like about it, which I won't recite verbatim because we've only got so much time, is he lists kind of 7 things that are like common factors in sword and sorcery, but says, look, you don't actually checkmark all 7 or it's not sword and sorcery. It's about having, as he says, I'm not even going to give you a number, but just if there's enough of these things in the story that it feels right to you, congratulations, you are reading or writing sword and sorcery, which I think is a really nice, flexible way of looking at it. But nonetheless, you want to try and have enough of these things in there that it feels right. But within the boundary, so to speak, it's like you can almost treat it like... you know, I've joked about it with friends and said it's kind of like you have a really demented wrestling ring, with like each of those 7 points being like a post, but running between them are those stretchy ropes, right? So you can be within those posts, but you can lean into those ropes and stretch what you can do within the genre. And Robert E. Howard himself famously would drape it like a cloak over other genres. You go back to the oldest, you know, Conan stories, and, you know, some of them, God in the Bowl is like a locked room mystery with sword and sorcery draped over it. Beyond the Black River is like a cowboy Western frontier story with sword and sorcery draped over it. So there's just so much possibility within the genre. And so I'm just looking for people who are exploring those possibilities within it rather than just trying to like clone, you know, a very straightforward, you know, big fellow, big sword hits things and gets treasure and then, you know, it's all over kind of thing. And then for the nonfiction, I'm really looking for stuff, you know, we do historical profiles of people from the history of the genre that maybe haven't got the attention they should. Like C.V. Goldsmith was an editor that basically was responsible for sword and sorcery being revived in the 60s. She did incredible work. Or we look for essays that try and illuminate possibilities and get people excited about the breadth of what you can do within it. You know, John Alford gave us an essay last year on neurodivergence and sword and sorcery, looking for both kind of like evidence of it being portrayed better or worse in the history of the genre, but also saying, well, hey, check it out. You know, he's a neurodivergent author, and he says, well, here's what I'm going to suggest of possibilities going forward as well. You know, it's all about getting people to like better understand the past and be more excited about what they can do in the present and future. So yeah, I think that's probably a decent answer to your question. I'll shut up for a second.
Thank you. So we mentioned the Kickstarter campaign that launches next week from this time that we're recording. So tell us a little bit more about that. Like, for example, what are you hoping to gain from the crowdfunding, and how will it impact the magazine's future success?
Okay, so I should clarify again. Sorry, it sounds like such a well actually response, but it's on BackerKit. It's not Kickstarter, but I don't blame you for saying that because for so long Kickstarter has been synonymous with crowdfunding, right? Mm-hmm. But then maybe you remember about a year ago, if you pay attention closely to that kind of thing, you'll know from a year ago they started messing around with blockchain or crypto or whatever, and really put off a lot of people. And so all of a sudden, a lot of people sort of fled it to try other platforms. New platforms arose, and the most interesting, compelling one to me was BackerKit, because BackerKit is not a new company. Their full service platform is new, but for over a decade, they've actually been something that people who run Kickstarters would glue on the back of their campaign, allowing them to charge shipping later and to like do a pre-order store on the back end. It just really helped with fulfillment, long story short. So after they've been helping fulfill people's campaigns for 10 years and saw that Kickstarter was kind of shitting the bed a little bit, they went, well, what if we did the whole thing? What if we were the whole platform? And they just came out of beta with that, and it looks amazing. I could drown you for an hour with details, but just trust me when I say I think it is a superior platform for both people running campaigns like myself and people who are going to back them. It just works really well. The main thing is it gives me a lot of options to turn it into kind of a party. You know, there's a lot of community aspects to it that I really like and I'm excited about, including lots of inbuilt stuff for like fun live streams. So one thing I'm looking forward to with our campaign that launches on February 15th for 30 days is we're going to try and keep it like kind of a fun party and give people a reason to like be interested in the campaign all the way through, rather than just kind of going, please give me money for, you know, once a day, every day for 30 days. Although we are, you know, doing that, let's be honest. So yes, I'm hoping for funds to produce issues 3 and 4. Again, we're going to be traditionally printing, so it'll be digital soft cover formats and our gorgeous hardcovers that I really love as a physical object lover when it comes to books. You know, they're stitch bound and they lay perfectly flat. It's proper book paper, not like glossy, easily torn magazine paper. You know, nice cream. And it's got bookmark ribbons built in. And it's a secret right now, but I will say there is a secret mega book enhancement that may come in later, depending on how it goes. So we might make the hardcovers even prettier. They're definitely a bit collectible. You know, we only printed about 130 last year of each issue, and number one just sold out a couple of days ago.
Congratulations.
Cheers. Yeah. So, they're very fun. I really love them. But yeah, as I said, we've got classic soft cover as well. And of course, we want, you know, all the digital formats. It makes it nice and accessible and also easier for international backers, because shipping from the States is bonkers. Which is why actually our first stretch goal is one we had last year that I love, double art. If we get that again, every story will get 2 illustrations, which is lovely. If we get the one after that, that's an international shipping discount. So if our second stretch goal is just a pot of money to make shipping cheaper for people in Canada, they get $5 off, and for everybody else in that one big country called international, we'll get... we'll get $10 off their shipping. And then after that, we're very big on supporting creators, as I mentioned. So every single stretch goal after that, it just alternates between a pay bump for the authors, a pay bump for the artists, back and forth, authors and artists to infinity. There's no cap on that. So hopefully we'll raise lots of money and be able to pay our creators even more than we already are. I hope to get that funding real much, because I want to do those issues. I want to get the stories out there. You know, we're reprinting a classic Elric story that was not collected in the quote-unquote complete collection. So he's returning with Michael Moorcock. We've got, Harry Turtledove, who has a long record with the alternative history tales. So he's doing kind of stories set in our history here. And just like a whole bunch of other authors, Premi Muhammad, June Orchid Parker's returning. A whole bunch of names I could throw at you. But yeah, I really want to publish those stories and get them out there. I really want to get the art out there. I love the art so much. The creative direction for doing working with the artists on that is something I really get a huge kick out of. And if you go to the campaign page, you can see like little, you know, samples of everybody, and it's just chef's kiss. I'm excited about the thing itself. I'm excited to try some new stuff. We've got some add-ons that we're bringing in. For example, you know how in a lot of crowdfunds, people like to have a thank you page if it's a book, you know, just listing everybody. And we did that last year, and there's nothing wrong with that. But this year I was like, what can we do that's a little different? What does somebody, I haven't seen this done, at least in other magazines. Did you have sticker books as kids? You know, and you have like the picture frame that's like number 38. You buy packs of stickers that are randomized, hoping to get, you know, 38 to put in that one.
Yes.
And so on.
Oh,
that,
yeah.
Yeah. So the last page of issue 3 is going to be a sticker book page. And all the backers are going to get one sticker that'll be like a 650 word flash fiction that takes up half the page. And then like, you know, everybody who backs it in the first 48 hours will get, another sticker that's an illustration for that story. Mm-hmm. And then everybody who's like a returning backer, because we can track, even though we've moved platforms, right? We can track who got backed us last time. They will get a sword and sorcery themed cocktail recipe, which is something we did last year as a hoot to fill some back page space. Our social media coordinator, Kevin, loves to make cocktails. And so he would come up with themed ones for different characters and like ingredients that made sense for them, and a little illustration to go with that. So yeah, we're going to have a fun sticker page at the back of issue 3. And I can't wait to see what people think of that. Plus, a whole bunch of other stuff will reveal over the course of the campaign. So because, you know, we feel like we've got making the magazine down pretty good now. So what else can we do? Plus, this is the biggie for me personally. We're not mentioning it on the campaign page, but if we fund, I've got plans to expand the magazine out into becoming a proper little publisher. We're going to put out, I hope, a couple of books this year, if the magazine succeeds funding this time around. So yeah, I'd say that's probably the main meat and potatoes of what I'm hoping, is to get to do all this fun stuff, and to get to have a lot of fun, as I say, in the community party thing of the live streams we're doing. You know, we're doing one that's going to be like a dungeon synth sort of DJ party mixed with interviews with the musicians. There's just so much overlap between that genre of music and the genre of writing, you know, that we're doing, especially the arts side of it. You know, we're going to have another one which will be like a panel discussion of a contemporary sword and sorcery short story, which is something we like to do on our Discord every month anyway, right? Because the classics get discussed so much. We're like, well, let's talk about the new authors and what they're doing, right? So that's another evening. And definitely, you know, we're going to do what we did last year, which is the last Friday night of the campaign. We're going to have like a telethon, you know, going for several hours and people doing shots every time there's a new stretch goal hit or whatever. And I'm still trying to close the deal with the person I want to bring in to run this, but we're probably going to have like a role-playing game session that the audience can like shout at and tell us what to do, that kind of thing. So yeah, anyway, again, way too long an answer. Sorry, you can hear I'm really excited and it's almost upon us. So I'm just frothing at the mouth about everything I want to do.
No, we're excited with you. You're making my neurodivergent senses tingle with the stickers and the hardcovers and things. I'm like, oh, I want it.
And I'm really into Dungeons and Dragons, and I listen to a lot of podcasts. So this sounds the last thing you mentioned sounds very similar to it. So it's like,
Well, it's funny actually, because as you can imagine, there's a not small amount of overlap between you know, TTRPG enthusiasts and sword and sorcery, and there's a connection with that here. So you remember I mentioned earlier, Jorella Jory, we're bringing her back, you know, brand new story, first 185 years, authorized with the Estate of Steel Moore. That all came out of the fact that in 2022, there was a campaign for on Kickstarter for a role-playing game setting based around her stories, her original first five stories, called Black God's Kiss, named after the most well-known story. It did very well, and it had a really wonderful artist who did all the art for it, called Saprophile, that's her alias. And I thought, she looks great. You know, her art's wonderful. So I tapped her. We actually had her in the magazine last year. But then last spring, I was sitting there going, you know, okay, who am I going to have for next year? You know, oh God, I definitely want to have her back. She's great. Wait a minute. If those role-playing game guys got the rights to Jorella Jory, maybe I could get the rights to... Anyway, a few emails and boring paperwork later, it's not a compelling story. I got the rights for, you know, hurrah. Found an excellent author to work with for it, Molly Tanzer, who's done all kinds of wonderful books, as well as edited the Swords versus Cthulhu anthology. She really gets the character, believe me, man. She's perfect. Yeah, so of course we're going to have Saprophile illustrate the Jorelle story as she did for the role-playing game thing. So yeah, anyway, I'm kind of giving it away. I haven't gotten a response to my email yet, but I'm hoping we'll run the Jorelle role-playing game that Friday night telethon. So that's what I'm looking forward to there. But anyway.
Amazing. Sounds very busy.
Yeah, it's a lot. I started planning this in like September. I think it's when I started working on the crowdfund as a whole. And actually, that would be my unsolicited advice to anybody watching. If you want to do a crowdfund, you can't start early enough. But that will keep it from being overwhelming, right? That's the thing. If you start like a week beforehand.
Yeah, I understand. So you claim to follow a boundary pushing approach, which you mentioned a little bit. What does this entail for you? And are there any boundaries in particular you'd like to break in publishing, especially in the swords and sorcery world?
Well, there's lots of angles to that. I mean, part of it's sort of the diversity, equity, inclusion thing, right? Trying to make it, you know, break the sort of boundaries of how the demographics of the thing are a bit monolithic, I guess. But aside from that, also I encourage our authors to play around and maybe explore themes that you don't see show up as often in the genre. You know, for example, oh my God, my brain just broke, but luckily I've got issue 2 in front of me. The author will be so... Yeah, right. TK Rex has a story in our issue 0, and with her mum actually co-wrote a story in issue 2, both of which explore environmental themes, which you just don't see as much in the classic SNS tales. So I try and encourage people, like, what are themes that maybe you haven't seen as much that you'd like to try to check out? You know, would you like to try maybe non-Western story structures? You know, how much can we mess with this thing and still keep it recognizable, right? I think it's a really interesting challenge. I think it's a real, you know, why not both kind of situation, you know, make it look like Sword and Sorcery, but do something you haven't seen before. So storytelling modes, I guess, is one thing. Otherwise, it's just a case of trying to see what other people are having success with in the broader science fiction fantasy scene and seeing, well, what can we do with that, with this? Like, Sword and Sorcery, it was birthed out of short stories, right, in the pulp magazines in the 30s. And by and large, if you look for Sword and Sorcery novels, you know, you'll find classic paperbacks from the 70s or whatever. They're like 150 pages. You know, this is not George R.R. Martin type stuff, you know. Although, of course, he was inspired by it. In fact, House of Dragon, oh my God, if you know Elric, anyway, Matt Smith's character, whatever, that's a whole other story. But I'm looking at what other people are doing and seeing how it could work with this. Why am I talking about the shorter format thing? Because what I'd like to work towards, if, you know, this next crowdfund does well, blah, blah, and I go into books, is serialized storytelling at the novella level. Right. You know, if you pay attention to, say, Tor, you know, the big publisher, they have had a lot of success publishing novellas, often bring people in for a one or two book deal. If it does well, they keep going. You get a series like with the Murderbot Diaries. Right. You know, wonderful series that. And so I'm thinking, like, man, Sword and Sorcery, you know, it works best as kind of shorter formats, episodic. But short stories and magazines, I love them, but they're a little harder to promote. They're a little harder to get people into, unfortunately. So something that's like, you know, a book. I'm thinking, okay, well, I'm going to try out Sword and Sorcery novella series, episodic. You can pick up volume 3 and start there, you know, but you'll probably want to go back and get the other ones. Have them written in a way so you can pick up any volume, but if you read them all, you get rewarded with the Easter eggs and that kind of thing. You see the development going on. That's something in terms of the publishing, pushing boundaries of what's been done with Sword and Sorcery in recent years that I really want to try out. I think that could work really well. And then, you know, art styles, for example. Again, I love the traditional stuff, but I'm also looking at a lot of artists who do things a little differently in other styles that you don't identify as much with Sword and Sorcery, say your Frank Frazetta or your Bronn or that kind of thing. So yeah, I'm just constantly looking at, as I say, ways, like, in every aspect of it, how I can experiment but keep it recognizable. I think that's the sweet spot in the middle for me.
As for the inclusivity aspect, what sort of representation are you hoping to feature more of, or has felt particular, or like what kind of representation felt a particular important to you?
I mean, honestly, everything outside of my own little demographic bingo card of white cishet male. I want to see more people who come from financially impoverished backgrounds, because writing should be accessible along those lines. You know, it can be frustrating when you hear about writing workshops and they sound exciting, and then it's like, if you can just not work for 6 weeks, you too can do, you know, Clarion West or whatever, which is not to poo-poo Clarion West. I mean, I have a Clarion author in issues 1 and 2, zero and two, but you get my point there, right? I think that's an aspect of diversity that doesn't get discussed as often. And then otherwise, I mean, just you name it, I want to see more of it. I want to see more disability, you know, in the writing. I want to see more trans people by far, you know. I want more of everybody. I mean, that's the glib but correct answer. I don't have any one specific group or intersectional groups I'm really gunning for. I kind of look at what I'm doing and what I've done and go, okay, let's try and get some more over here that I maybe haven't done as much of yet, kind of thing, you know? So I'm just, it's going to be constantly sort of rotating for me, I suppose, in a way. But it's like, I think transness is just, it's SNS as fuck. And the reason I say that is because I think of Sword and Sorcery very strongly as a genre of the body, right? You go back and read through the classic stuff. I mean, aside from just the art that I mentioned, like Frank Frazetta, where it's lots of like oiled, muscly bodies, there's a lot of like athleticism. There's a lot of agency found through the body. There's, you know, the romance side of it that comes up occasionally, and that I plan to lean into, hopefully with a book in the future. But anyway, and just in general, like, you know, these are characters who live and survive, yes, by the wits, but also very much by the bodies that they move them through their worlds. And then I just think about trans people, and not that all trans people have to go the route of surgery, but I just think it's so fucking cool how they, you know, most trans people take agency with their bodies and say, I'm gonna be the most me I can, and I'm gonna go out there and do this really, you know, serious thing. And I just think that plays into Sword and Sorcery's themes really well. So I guess I do tend to focus a little bit on that. I definitely tried to sort of be inspiring, encouraging, aside from publishing a trans author. On our issue 1 cover, if you look for it, I every issue after one is going to be like a scene from a story, right, on the cover. That's just, you know, classic tradition, right? But issue one, I was like, well, this is the brand, you know? What do we do for the brand? I mean, I'm lucky we've got a lovely logo, a double-headed battle axe that's like looking forward to the future and back to the classics, you know? I love that. But what's going to be on the cover of issue one? I thought about it. And I remember I keep talking about this sweet spot, right? Between tradition and pushing things and trying to do both. Why do you don't have to choose? And there's a Frank Frazetta painting. I mean, he is the artist that gets associated with the genre, called, if I remember correctly, Against the Gods. And it's a picture of a classic one of his muscly fellows in a loincloth standing on a ledge. And he's just going like, wow, you know, his arms are out and he's looking to the sky and his face is actually almost shadowed. The light from the sky, as there's lightning and everything, it's very dramatic and over the top. The light is actually more in his chest. And I remember looking at that and thinking about it and going, hang on. What if we make this barbarian a trans man and this focus on the chest shows off not only the scars of battle, but scars from claiming themselves, you know, through assumingly double mastectomy. And I thought, that's pretty good. So I ran that by some trans friends. I was like, am I putting my foot in my mouth here? You know, I just want to double check. And you uniformly, it was like, yeah, do it. So I was like, okay. So, you know, we found a great artist, Katarina Gerbezi, and I pitched the idea to her. She was like, yeah, great, okay. So yeah, and that's what we ended up having on the cover. And to my delight, I have had a few people react and say, thank you. It was really nice to, you know, people seeing on this cover. And to me, that was our way of, you know, signaling, you know, that was our kind of bat signal of like, yeah, we want to be including everybody and pushing things, but also if you know the classics, you'll get what we're riffing off of here. I've lost the plot, but I think I answered your question.
Yeah. I got a little emotional just now.
That was really lovely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cheers.
So just a quick listener question we got from Lillian.
Yes.
As a little bit of a, yeah, a little bit of a fun one. What's your favorite weapon?
That's easy. Not that I've wielded it myself, so maybe it's my favorite one to read about and see in movies. A Warhammer. I mean, I did enjoy the Warhammer games as a kid, but no, I mean the literal Warhammer. I just think it's fun. You don't see it quite as often, and also there's little variations on it. Like I'm very slowly finishing the outline for a massive sword and sorcery novel. It's like 17 stitched together stories. One of them's novella length. I've given myself too much work. But anyway, in that, my protagonist throughout all of that, she wields a big Warhammer. And what I love is the way that Warhammers often have the smashy bit that we all think of on one side, but on the other side, like a beak, you know, like a spike. Just gives you kind of fun options for combat and also for decoration of the thing. I describe in my character's Warhammer actually having it engraved to look like a raven's beak on one side, and on the other side a flat mashed up boar's head kind of thing. So boar in the beak, I don't know, I like it. So yeah, I would say definitely that, especially because we also tend to think Warhammers as being huge, and the one I'm describing is, but you know, you can get smaller ones as well, and also think you can double it as a tool in a way that's a less obvious than a sword cutting a rope, let's say. And maybe it's also, yeah, actually now I think about it, maybe it's also because as it has chance would have it, I'm the child of a pair of goldsmiths. I grew up around their workshop, and I'm thinking about my dad wielding little hammers and things and whatnot. So, you know, maybe there's something there. Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah, Warhammer. That would be my answer.
Thank you.
Good answer.
Yeah. I'm a stabber. I wanted something to stab people with.
So. I love a bow and arrow.
That too, yeah.
Standard.
Yeah. What's wrong with that? Classics. So we have to slowly wrap up. So before we go, we start our podcast saying what we're enjoying. So do you have any TV, film, books, magazine, games, podcasts, anything, any recommendation on what you're currently enjoying or what you would just want to give a shout out about?
Lots of stuff. I mean, I just finished Blue Eye Samurai on Netflix. That was really fun. Definitely felt like I promoted some of the stuff I'm doing, which is nice. And Scavenger's Reign, another good animated series. But God, I should have a sword and sorcery book off the tip of my tongue here, shouldn't I? You know what? I'll recommend. I'm continuing to enjoy. I mentioned Tales from the Magician's Skull, which is a wonderful magazine edited by Howard Andrew Jones. In fact, I'm just going to give a little bit of Howard Andrew Jones love. I'm going to say, please check out the magazine Tales from the Magician's Skull, which, like us, has a high production value and beautiful art and all that good stuff. And I would also recommend. Howard has got a great book series that's been coming out over the last year, starring his character Hannibal, which is basically his sort of secondary world riff on like Hannibal, right, from ancient Rome and Carthage and all that. And his whole premise is basically like, well, what if after Carthage was crunched, you know, by the Romans, Hannibal was actually alive, and then he went on kind of a rescue mission to free all of the enslaved Carthaginians? from under the Roman heel. So, you know, it's got different names, right? They're not called the Carthaginians, they're not called the Romans, but that's what we're doing here, right? And he writes them in a way that I think is really wonderful, because he too is trying to bring things forward while keeping what worked in the genre. Each book, and there's two out so far, third one's already on pre-order, he's been working hard. Each one is a string of short stories, and it's kind of like reading a TV season, right? Each story works absolutely on its own, but you read it in order and it all strings together into a bigger narrative. I really, really loved the first book, and I've been pecking at the second book as much as I can around all the preparation of the, you know, crowdfund and the new puppy I got. Oh boy. Yeah, I think that's why I'd really recommend. I'd recommend people check out the Hanavar book series strongly. You know, and just Howard Andrew Jones in general. He's a really lovely guy and he does wonderful writing, and he really gets sword and sorcery through and through. He's actually been a huge inspiration for me. Tales from the Magician's Skull, when we were starting, when Nathan and I were first thinking, what are we going to do for this magazine? We eventually moved on, obviously, but first we were like, rip off the skull? Like, well, you know, just like, how could you do better? So that's what I'd recommend. Check out Howard Andrew Jones in general, the magazine and the book series in particular.
Okay, great. Thank you. Well, we have to wrap it up, but thank you so much for talking to us. We can't wait to see what you do next with the magazine. And you've definitely got us interested. I'm very interested.
Well, thanks for helping me get the word out. Like I say, we're trying to connect with new audiences and so on. So this is all really appreciated.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. This was really fun.
Oh yeah, by the way, issue one in hardcover, issue two in soft coverage. I realize that you as a video, so do.
Go on YouTube self. I feel really cunty with the microphone in my hand.
You look really cunty with the microphone in your hand, especially with your new haircut.
Yeah, that's true. Anyway, we had a wonderful interview with Oliver.
We did. Lots to think about, lots to ponder. Yeah. I really love it when we talk to people who you can tell how passionate they are about what they're talking about. So good.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. So as we said in the interview, be sure to back the Kickstarter for lots of cool, varied prizes. Not prizes, rewards. What's the thing? Gifts? I don't know.
I don't know.
Words have evaded me.
Yeah. I'm still thinking about the stickers.
I really want the stickers. And I want the hardbacks with the bookmark.
Oh, yeah.
That book.
Yeah.
Because I was thinking, the whole time he was talking about that, I was just thinking about how much I love that, like, the comic, our comics now come in, like, hardback as well. I think it's so nice to have like a collector's thing that is in a hardback.
Yeah,
I can't believe we didn't used to do it sooner.
Yeah, absolutely. Even like I have National Geographic, which is not, I wouldn't call it a hardback, but it's a very thick cover, and having all of them next to each other, it's doing something to me. Like you see you see the spine and it's beautiful. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't get ruined quick easily.
Yeah. And I actually got a sneak peek of the front cover of the next edition, which I will send to you in a minute. And one of the things that I noticed first about the magazine was how pretty the art was in New Edge Sword and Sorcery. So I really think, you know, you're onto something if you grab yourself a copy of these.
Yeah, and when we were like, when I was going through it, because we got also a preview of the two. Well, we got the two issues. So when I was like scrolling through it, I just, the way it's done, which is like three columns, there are like pictures here and there and ads. It really reminded me of like a classic newspaper from like 1970s, 1950s. And I just got a flashback when I was studying it, and I went to like our national library to grab some older copies to read through them. It was just, I got those same vibes.
Yeah, it kind of reminds you of like the joy of going grabbing some like a magazine or something as a kid.
Yeah.
Like for adults. And I hope he doesn't mind me saying, but Sword and Sorcery in general feels like a very neurodivergent centered genre. Like,
absolutely.
So it feels like very, it feels right. It feels good. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it was very on brand for us, actually.
Yeah, and even the RPG sort of a game based on some specific books, I just got a flashback to my teenage years when the RPG was like really big here, and we were mostly doing like the Vampire Diaries, and you got a few characters and you were just in a chat for hours, hours on end, and you were just the characters, and it was hilarious.
I never did those, but like just in general as a daydreaming weirdo in school, we used to play fucking Doctor Who, Scooby Doo, like I forgot. I love that when you become an adult, you learn that those things that you used to feel silly for as a kid is actually really cool and nerdy and fun to do.
Absolutely.
So I guess since we talk sword and sorcery, we can keep it on brand for the episode. Where are you at with sword and sorcery? Do you have any like standout media or anything?
Thing is, again, I don't necessarily understand what fits under the genre.
Yeah.
So, and because especially when it comes to like fantasy, there's so many subgenres that I just am confused which is which.
I think we read a lot of books that include sword and sorcery, but like sword and sorcery as a genre is perhaps something a little bit different. I know definitely that the one that springs to mind for me is Guinevere's Under the Ice Skies, Jason and the Astronauts series. Well, first of all, it says it on the tin that it includes sword and sorcery.
Oh, well.
But it's what I love about it is that it's also like tied into Greek myth retellings with Jason and the Golden Fleece and whatnot. Mm-hmm. I think she did first. And also it's sci-fi as well. So it's not like limited to a fantasy setting. I think she did a lot with that. And that makes me excited to see more about what swords and sorcery might be, aside from like the preconceptions we might have of it, I guess.
Yeah. When I like first read these two words, all I could think of is Dungeons and Dragons. So I don't know if that would fit up.
I'm sure it would.
Yeah. It's not helping me though with thinking of what all the like what I read on in the genre. I do read a lot of urban fantasy, which kind of gives me the similar vibe, even though I don't know if it's the same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, like with no, there were a lot of sorcerers. And of course, like Kay Daniels. That's urban fantasy, though. I don't know. I genuinely don't know.
The episode's just us trying to figure out what. I hope Oliver doesn't listen to this part because he was so intelligent and knowledgeable. And now we're just being us. And she's disappeared on me.
Because my dog decided it was enough of being her, of her being like. Actually kind of calm.
Yeah.
And went to tear up my tissue.
Of course. Well, she was very well behaved for the rest of the interview. So she was very well behaved for the rest of the interview.
Yeah, though I did at the beginning, I heard her like fumble with my water bottle, the plastic one, and she got another tissue.
I was thinking as well about how much mythology seemed, especially like Welsh and English mythology seems to be like include at least or be steeped in sword and sorcery. I was thinking a lot about Merlin.
and King Arthur. Yeah, absolutely.
It's good to know, like, if we ever delve into that genre, that I bet there's a lot more to it than we can really see now. Especially as authors, I'm sure there's a lot of like historic texts and influences there that we can't really even begin to speak on because we're underqualified.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, aside from sword and sorcery, what have you been enjoying this week?
Crescent City came out recently, so I've been that.
Yeah.
Wrecked me, so 10 out of 10.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got okay. I'll get the title right. A Demon's Guide to Wooing a Witch by Sarah. I don't know how you pronounce her
Holly?
Name. Yeah,
Howley. Howley.
You know me, Dan W's. And that was exquisite. It was so much fun. I really love her books. So I'm really
it's excited. Good timing to talk about this, I would say, because there has been yet more discourse over on Book Twitter now about romanticity. Some editor tweeted, "Hey, writing community, I've got news for you because I am the font of all knowledge." this is paraphrasing. They said, "Romanticity does not equal fantasy and romance. Romanticity equals fantasy and erotica." And I was... I've read several romanticies and none of them can be classified as erotica because erotica is its own genre in which the plot is driven by erotic acts.
Yeah.
Is it not? So that was a thing. And I was thinking about Sarah Hawley and how she does really great smut, but the plot is very driven by romance. The smut can be taken out and it would still be a story in itself. So that was a thing.
Yeah.
And of course, that discourse like completely excludes asexuals, people who just don't actually want to write sex or erotica in general. And it's just, I just want to say, like, as a side note, if you're a newer author and you're exposed to a lot of these opinions that seem off, please, like, don't listen to everything you see on the internet because there's a lot of misinformation I've found. Like, aside from the obvious where people are like, oh, you can't use adverbs because that's a sign of an amateur writer. Like, aside from that, even, like, people who appear professionals on the internet apparently don't know the difference between romance and erotica. Mm-hmm. So, like, it really scares me as an author for, like, the future generations who are exposed to so many opinions. So that's something.
Mm-hmm.
That's something. But yeah, continue.
Yeah. Anyway, that was really, it was really fun. Really, really great. I have to say, like, what Sarah is doing so fucking well is that, I think that's her only a second book. I'm not sure if she has something else outside of the series, but each character in these two books is so different from one another. And yes. I really, really love it. So especially when you have like these standalones, romance series where each are like tied together. Like the first character you have Marielle, she's plus sized and short, I think. And like Galadia, I think you pronounce her name. In the second one, she's very like more masculine. She is like very muscly, and it's really. I really love it. I really love it.
And the same with the love interest. Like, yeah. I was saying to you, I've actually been struggling to pick up the second book because on the UK cover of this book, the guy reminds me of Aziraphale.
Oh.
From Good Omens.
I don't know how.
So I cannot look at him without seeing a jolly middle-aged gay man in a white suit, which is wonderful, but. Changes the romance for me slightly. So, but what I'm saying is that it's a good thing.
Yeah, and you know what? I of course because he's blonde, and that's really all I need. He's immortal, so I imagine him as Astarion from Baldur's Gate 3, and they had like a lot of sort of common characteristics from all the edits that I saw from Astarion, though. So like he's similarly funny, and he's also, I mean, this demon lived for 600 years, so he's not picky when it comes to his sexual contact. So, like, he's very queer, and I fucking love that for me.
How is he?
Yeah. He even said, like, because they were, okay, so this is perhaps a PG something conversation, but there was, they talked about pegging, and he was really? Like, darling, I lived for 600 years. There's very little that I didn't do. And if there is something, I'd love to try it. I was like, fuck yeah.
This changes things.
I know. And that's what I mean, like, when we're talking about vampires and people are like, they're not queer. Every fucking vampire is queer because if you live for so long, you're just going to, even if you started off straight, you're going to transform to being queer because otherwise what a boring life that would be.
I mean, like, if you can be immortal and your sexuality doesn't change a little bit, there's something wrong. Yeah. But, like, and if I was straight and immortal, I probably would tear my own head off its shoulders just to make sure I died properly, because I can't imagine a world where I live forever and don't kiss a girl.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm kind of there already.
I was about to say, like, we're so passionate about it, but also the way we're living our lives is quite...
I'm not a vampire, I'm just autistic, so, like, you can't expect that from me.
Like, I would hate to be straight, and yet, when a pretty girl looks at me, I burst into panic and run away. And possibly I'm going to give her, like, resting bitch face. Anyway, and then I go home and read.
It is Valentine's Day when this episode goes out.
Mm.
Ivy kindly asked me to be her Valentine this year.
Yeah, I did. I did. Yeah.
Made me feel some type of way.
Anyway, what else I've been enjoying? I started Ruthless Vows by Rebecca Roth, which is the second book and the duology Divine Rivals, which is absolutely amazing. It's absolutely amazing. If you think it's overhyped, it's not. It deserves more hype. It's so fucking good, and I recommend
it. I have a confession to make.
Oh, God.
I kind of get confused between... At first, I thought maybe Rebecca Yarros was also Rebecca Ross.
I had the same thing.
Yeah. They came out at similar times, and I saw that Rebecca Yarros was writing other things before Fourth Wing, and I just got a little bit confused.
I know, it's just two letters extra in the name. I absolutely understand. I have the same issue. And especially when I was like trying to Google the if I can like purchase it here, the hardback for the second book, I was like, I really genuinely forgot how to spell their name. So I kind of had them. I had them next to each other, ironically. So I had to turn to my bookshelf to consult which is which.
Yeah. The hard life of being a reader.
Yeah. Yeah, but I have hardbacks, so that's also something that I deserve to brag about.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And otherwise, from books, I think that's... Oh, yeah, I started listening Emily Wilde's Encyclopedia of the Fairies on audiobook, which is really good audiobook, and I recommend it. And that's for reading for now for me all. So what about you?
I've been the same. I've been reading Sarah J. Maas again, 10 out of 10, no notes. And I was listening to, I ended up finishing the Hunger Games in audiobook because, first of all, I have too many physical books that I'm reading right now, and I've read it before, so it's a reread. And I want to really get to the Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes.
Yes. And also, the trilogy is now narrated by Tatiana Maslany.
Which is where I was going, yeah. It's narrated by Tatiana Maslany, and I love her so fucking much. And she puts on this great voice for Peter. I mean, she's very used to, like, using her vocals as a way of acting, because she played 12 versions of herself in Orphan Black. So she knows how to switch it up. And she does a great job. And I love having her in my ears in a very gay way.
Absolutely. Honestly, I feel like she should just do this much more. Mm-hmm. If, like, right now she switched her careers a little bit to audiobook narrating, and I understand, I guess it doesn't have as much money as She-Hulk, but I would just, I want to listen more of books, but, like, narrated by her. It's just so good.
I also want more TV shows where she's the only actress in it.
That's
where she plays all the characters.
Yeah.
I love her very much, yeah.
Yeah.
And I have been reading Just You by Melina Garance, which is another beautiful, beautiful romance. It's a Killian, this one. The men are idiots, which is wonderful.
Based John on real world.
Yeah, I was going to say John is very me-coded, because I too would kiss my best friend and then walk away and go missing for 3 days without consulting how they might be feeling about it.
Amazing.
It's great. Melina Garance we talk a lot about how our books are kind of similar. I mean, I would never put myself on her level. They are just a wonderful author. In that, like, it's very character driven and the characters feel very real. They are also neurodivergent authors, so I feel like I relate a lot more to the way they're at. And as I've mentioned before, Andy from The Flourishing is my biggest book girlfriend ever. Yeah, so I can't emphasize enough. And in that vein, Melina Garance is actually holding a Killian book bingo. We're going to have them on the show later April, because that's when it's starting in April. But you can get all the information now, download the bingo cards, stuff like that. And if you're an author, you can also submit your book for like giveaways and stuff, just so that you're a part of it a little bit more. So it's great visibility as well. So if you like, if you're listening to this, you've probably took part in Jay's Sapphic book bingo. And it's like that, but for Achillean, because Melina realized that there are no Achillean book bingos. Like, it's strange. I was talking to her about this. Like, it's strange because Achillean started the queer genre a little bit, I would say. But you see now Sapphic books have a lot of resources, like I Heart Sapphic and the Sapphic book bingo and whatnot. And there's very little there for Achillean.
I would go ahead. I would like also possibly put that to Achillean books are sort of like self-promoted these days. Like,
yeah,
if
yeah.
Straight people go read queer books, they pick up Achillean ones.
Yeah,
and like Sapphic ones, and the rest is still needs like a little bit more support there, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. But then, like, I think that causes a little bit of suffering on indie Achillean authors, because obviously in traditional publishing, it's mahusive. Like, there are men everywhere you look.
Yeah.
But in indie publishing, because we're so like content and intent and determined to lift Sapphic voices, I think it's had like an adverse effect, maybe.
Yeah.
Not adverse, but just in the way that they've kind of fell, and there's just not as much there for Achillean indie authors, I want to say. And I think Melina themselves has found that, because for me, like, I find it a lot easier to promote Sapphic books and get readers for Sapphic books than if I write like MF romances. So I feel like there's this huge Sapphic community now, yeah, it's just great to see that Melina's working on that for Achillean authors as well.
Anything else you were reading?
No.
What are you watching these days?
Actually, we did start Brianna Bailey's A Tale of Two Florists.
Oh yeah, that's it. That's right.
I don't need to get it. It came to me.
It's on my table. A plate is lying on the book, so I can't. I just see one sunflower there.
Yeah. But we were really excited about these books because they're later in life romances. Yeah. The first one and the second one, I think, is above Sapphic romances, set in a small town called Juniper Creek.
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was a real palate cleanser. We haven't, we're not that far in yet.
No.
But we started buddy reading it together. Yeah.
And it's very short, and it's very cheap on British Amazon, isn't it?
Yeah, the paperbacks are really cheap. Yeah. And yeah, I'm excited. It's really nice vibes, and it's nice to read older women for a change.
Yeah. And it also is very like, it's giving you a hope to like the future. The way I'm reading is, as I'm aging, I think I'm moving up to a different books.
Yeah.
And it's really like heartwarming to see that there is still something up.
Also in the way that, like, as an author, it's reassuring to know that I can age with my characters, can age with me as well. Like, when I'm middle-aged, I can write middle-aged characters and hopefully still find an audience for them. So that's nice.
Yeah.
Wonderful. If I get that far.
I laugh, but it's not funny. Okay, something you're watching?
I'm watching The Bear, and it's so good.
Yeah.
I'm loving it. It's Jeremy Allen White. He's a very stressed out chef in a very renowned restaurant that was left over from his brother. These two white men have a very black cousin relationship in that they're not actually related, but they're cousins nonetheless. And Ayo Edebiri is there, and she's phenomenal. And it's a found family situation. Like, they hate each other, they love each other. It's just, and I was saying to you that, like, I started it, it took me a minute to really, like, understand where we were at and what was happening, what they were trying to do. And then you get to the end of the first season and you're like, oh, so good, so yeah. good. And the second season has had a little bit more comedy as well. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking forward to carrying on with that. I'm on season two now.
Wonderful.
Yeah. How about you?
Well, I'm back on Modern Family, which I think I mentioned last episode that I was about to start. I started. and also kind of IO connected. Abbott Elementary is coming out now, season three. And she was in season two as the sister of, I'm looking at on names now too. What's her character named? I don't know. Quinta Benson, I think, is the actress, and the writer and producer or whatnot. She's everything there. So her sister, and she was amazing, and they were amazing, and Abbott Elementary is amazing, and I fucking love it, and everybody should watch it. There we go. Yeah, and that's really it. I also started Griselda on Netflix, which is Sofia Vergara. And I want to continue, but right now with watching Modern Family, I'm a little wary because like jumping from her as Griselda to her as Gloria is simply too much right now for my brain to handle. So we'll see.
I get it. Sorry.
No, go on.
I was just going to say, I've been stalling on Grey's because I know I have an episode solely around Owen and his sister in the war. Yeah. Don't care about Owen Hunt. Never cared about, that's a lie. I did care about Owen Hunt for a little bit when he was just a traumatized man who needed some therapy. But therapy couldn't help a man like Owen Hunt. So
no. And games. Do tell. Something interesting?
No.
No. No.
Nothing worth saying.
Yeah. Of course, Fortnite. I'm April O'Neil from Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Yeah.
And I've been playing a lot of phone games. So my beloved Dragon City, but also Tetris. And like the water game where you have like different colors in different bottles. And you like try to put one color into one bottle. That was fun.
I love that.
Yeah. And that's it.
Yeah.
That's it.
Mostly I'd just be crocheting the day away.
Yeah. And I'm back in reading and I love it.
I'm back in writing and I love it. I've been working on my witchy witches.
Mm.
I say witches plural, but the main character's only one is a witch, but
doesn't matter.
It's a state of mind if you ask me.
Yeah.
So I hit the halfway mark and I'm beyond it now, and that's exciting for me.
Yeah.
Oh, and I have a book coming out on Wednesday actually when this episode goes live. So you can you can't pre-order it because when the episode goes live, it will be out. So don't pre-order it because it won't. This Comes Marriage is coming out in ebook. It was already out in paperback. And it's a fake dating, married at first sight romance with a messy lesbian rock star and a plus size model, pansexual.
Hell yeah.
And I'm excited for it to be out in ebook because I really loved writing that one.
I know. It was really good.
There's a stay away from my wife moment that everybody deserves.
Everybody does, yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Loved it.
It's under Bryony Rosehurst, by the way. Don't be typing in my name. It's my pen name, Bryony Rosehurst. Okay.
Okay.
That was great promotion for me.
You always do so well with these.
I love self-promoting. I'm great at it.
So until next time.
Support women's rights.
But most importantly, support women's wrongs.
Especially if they are adept at swords and sorcery.
That's a good one.
I Thank you.
We shall see you later, alligator.
In a while, crocodile.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Swords and Sapphix. You can enjoy a new episode every Wednesday.
While waiting, you can visit our website, swordsandsapphix.com, and find lots of articles, interviews, and guest pieces.
Feel free to contact us with any requests, questions, or inquiries through a form on our website or directly to our email, swordsandsapphixpodcast@gmail.com.